Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. Today, I'm very excited to have Narig, the co-founder of Decrypted Law, here to talk to us a little bit about the legal landscape of crypto and his experience advising companies in the space. So, thanks so much for being here, Narig.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, to get started, it would be great just to tell people a little bit about your experience, your background. Maybe how you got into law and how you got interested in crypto afterwards.
It's a little bit of a funny story how I got into law, but I'll try to keep it short. I was always into sports growing up. I just happened to start watching a show called Entourage, if you're familiar, from back in the day. Realized that being an agent seemed pretty cool. I mean, Ari Gold's character was super entertaining. I looked into, what it takes, and you don't have to go to law school and become an attorney, but a lot of the good agents were. So that's what kind of started my path down going to law school. This was like when I was in undergrad. As I started getting closer to getting into law school, and I had some mentors and stuff who were attorneys, and they kind of said, it's more of a who you know business than what you know. So if you're okay with starting in the mailroom, go for it. And I wasn't. I just wasn't in the position to, get all that law school debt and then just, get a minimum wage job in the mailroom and hope to work my way up. So then, I had research papers to do, like for my securities laws class and corporate law classes, like seminars, like about halfway through law school, and I just fell upon crypto. It was like the hot topic in securities. How securities laws will apply, will be exempt, how the SEC is going to view crypto in general, Bitcoin and all the other altcoins. So then I wrote a research paper on that. It got published in our like law review journal, and that's kind of, I really like boosted my resume. I started working for an attorney that worked with a bunch of Web3 companies, and that landed me a job at a firm called Cooley, which is like a global law firm. They represent all types of emerging startups and tech companies and venture capitalists. I think most quarters they've represented the most venture-backed companies. So got a ton of great experience there, learned from some of the best of the best. And earlier this year, ventured out and started my own law firm. And I can get into like why that happened, but let me know if
Yeah,
that's
no, that's a
interesting.
great place to sort of break. And I think, yeah, I've spent a lot of money with Cooley, and I've spent a lot of money trying to find good crypto lawyers throughout the years. In the early days, like back in the ICO era, I advised a bunch of companies, and we were paying two lawyers $1,000 an hour to sit in the office 8 hours a day and just figure out how to not end up in jail for some of these companies. And I realized pretty quick that being on the bleeding edge of this was going to be a great place to be in law, accounting, all these spaces. So I think you definitely picked the right path.
It's the tough thing with Web3 crypto in general was, even now there's a ton of uncertainty, but a couple years ago it was like you could talk to five different attorneys and get five different opinions, because it was like, what's the risk appetite for that attorney? How do they view like what the SEC thinks? Like, it was all like predicting how we think like this thing is going to mature. And some firms were a lot more conservative. I think Cooley was a little bit more conservative, and I think for a good reason, honestly. You never want to give bad advice. And firms like maybe the ones who advised FTX, as you've seen, like have been, I don't want to name them, but they've been getting sued by FTX. It's like they probably were a little more liberal about their advice they were giving their clients.
Yep, no, I think who you pick was one of the most important things. And yeah, I found that we were getting contradictory advice constantly. And so it felt like it was counterproductive at some level because we really never knew what we could do. So I guess, taking it back to, I guess, the early days of your newest company, what were some of the like early projects that you maybe worked on, or some of the things that got you started in the space, or maybe were interesting that you might want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, a lot of them didn't pan out. They did,
Well, that happens too.
especially, at the time when I just started, it was still very taboo. A lot of companies were coming to us for just counseling on like ICOs, and generally we were very against that because we felt like any offering like that you do to the public will be viewed as a security and it's unregistered, which is a big problem. And it was, when you're legal counsel, what I would get a lot is like, hey, well, X, Y, and Z is doing it and they didn't get in trouble. Like, what about me? And it's like, yeah, but if I tell you you can do it and then you're the one who gets like, an enforcement action by the SEC, like you're gonna turn around and get upset with me. So we were turning down plenty of clients, but one really cool one that I got to work on from the very, very early days was NBA Top Shot, like the
Oh,
kind of
nice.
NFT company. That was super cool. Another one that's, just emerging into the public eye now that did a couple financings for like as part of the team was WorldCoin. So that was, super interesting. Like these were some cutting edge things that were long-term projects. NBA Top Shot like just popped off during the NFT, but they had been working on that thing for years. They started out with the crypto kitties and things. Like people, it seems like an overnight success, but it's not. Like it took 5 years for an overnight success. So those are two like pretty cool ones that are still around now.
Yeah, those are great examples. And I think it's cool you get to be in on the sort of ground floor and see the teams grow, see the challenges they face. You probably get a better look at that than almost anyone. Have you noticed, I guess, an evolution in the kinds of things that clients are coming to you for? I know you mentioned it was ICOs for a long time. Do you feel like that train has sort of left the station and people are moving towards, newer models? And if there are those newer models, are there, are you dealing more with DAOs and there's more confusion around that now, or any trends that you've noticed there?
Yeah, for a long time, DAOs were, we were getting requests like every day for a different DAO, and again, we felt like that was it was kind of it's like kind of a decentralized ICO when you think about it. It makes it a little bit more difficult for securities laws enforcement, but again, unless we really felt like there was no like interest in making a profit off of like the managers of the DAO, then if that existed, we kind of like stayed away from it, and I think for good reason. But like there were some like pretty cool DAOs that I was interested in at the firm, but I didn't work on directly. There was one that was like a private club where like if you ended up buying tokens, you'd get in. And you'd be part of like this art world, like where people were sharing ideas and stuff. That was super cool. But since then, like venture capital's super interested into it. Like maybe not this year, but previous years, that shifted most people away from public offerings, ICOs, DAOs, and things like that, and just raising money like traditional tech companies through venture capital, and seeing where that goes. Also, just a less of an interest in the public token and more in infrastructure, like just building the infrastructure for Web3. So seeing that was su super cool because even as someone who's been really into like crypto, Web3, whatever you want to call it now, I always felt like for the average person to get like onboarded, like the on-ramps were still very tough,
100%.
very tough. So I'm like very optimistic that these infrastructure companies will make that a lot more simpler. I think of it like, it was pretty hard to use dial-up back in the day to get on the internet. Like, couldn't use your phone and things like that at the same time. So, hopefully we're at that like bridge where we're making it to broadband, like the DSL cable days.
Yep, no, I I couldn't agree more with you there. And I'm surprised there haven't been some better on-ramps put out. I think Strike was really good while it was working for me, but they just had pretty terrible fraud protections, I think, and they started getting really bad chargebacks, and they banned me after like a week and I didn't do anything. And so I think that's a lot of the issue with the on-ramping is just getting smart enough about the consumer data so that they don't get chargebacks like crazy. Because I mean, that's the problem with crypto is it's instant settlement. So if you can instant settle, pull your money out and charge back, it works. There are a lot of companies that I know who have been working on things like that, and I think we'll see things like crypto credit scores start to come to fruition, and we'll have sort of a parallel economy to base some of that off of, which I think is pretty exciting. Would you say that, and this is interesting too, because I think internationally it's much easier. So a lot of these are sort of US specific. Have you, I don't know if you guys do any work with companies that are also, working abroad, but I was just curious if you've noticed big differences in domestic and international companies and the considerations that they're making, and if within the US, there are particular jurisdictions where you might advise clients to get set up.
Yeah, so that's a good question. The general advice that every firm is sort of giving right now is if you are going to have a publicly like traded token that's going to end up on Coinbase or whatever exchange someday, is work as hard as possible to make that token decentralized outside of the United States before introducing it to the US markets. One of the prongs of the Howey test is like that, there's kind of a single entity that you got the buyers are relying on for, create a profit. So if you could like spread as much of your tokens across the globe and out of the hands of the company and insiders before introducing it to the US, you might have a stronger argument that, hey, this thing is decentralized. Nobody really controls it, and nobody can rely on us to make that token more valuable. That's kind of the approach some companies have been taking. I think that is sort of what WorldCoin has been doing, which is why you hear them in being much more like popular in developing countries, where they're getting people signed up and things like that for a few years, and now they're finally introducing it to the US. So whenever we're advising a company who wants to go for that public token, it's like, well, you got to do that whole work with the geofencing and keeping it out of US as much as possible.
Yep, that makes sense. And it seems like, is there any like I guess consideration for like fair distribution? Like you have all these free mints on BRC20s and Bitcoin now, where you can just basically mint it out, and they're trying to create more fair distributions. Is that something that helps? Like if WorldCoin were to, instead of pricing it $3 or whatever for a billion tokens, just set it for free and airdropped it, does that help?
Yeah, I mean, it's again, airdrops are still a little uncertain whether you're distributing securities.
Got it.
More conservative legal professionals will say like that's not okay. But I take the stance that yeah, airdropping is more safe as long as you get a wide distribution of wallets. You don't want it like going to a handful of wallets. It just depends how that airdrop works, a lot of airdrops are like if you hold X amount of one token, you get like a pro rata of this token. Like that might not be fair if that original token it's based off of is like held in majority by like 10 wallets or something like that. So it really depends on context really. But speaking to like the core of your question, and when a company raises venture capital money, one of the things that's like heavily negotiated is what's called like the company reserve of the tokens. So the we'll try to keep that. We always try to argue to keep that as low as possible of the total supply, because the less supply that's reserved for the company and the insiders and VCs, the more gets distributed out to the general population eventually. And on top of that company insider token should be locked up, and that time period for the lockup starts after the token is actually launched to the public. So it's not like from when they raised money, it's like 3 or 4 years from when the token is actually out there. So you may have heard that like people were talking about how FTX has to sell off all this, I think it was Solana and things like that. Well, theirs is still under the lockup. Like, I don't think it's fully unlocked till 2025 or like 2028 or something like that. So they really don't have like control over those tokens yet.
But I think some of the VCs that got in earlier than them actually do have some control. So some of these guys, have they get in really early, they make sure to offload on retail. And I think a
True.
lot of those were liquid last cycle, so they managed to get out early. And so I guess, are there like things that you can actually programmatically create that help in that capacity? So can you create a smart contract that ensures that none of these tokens can be touched until the vesting date, or that the company treasury gets, the revenue gets distributed to users and investors on some set schedule? Does that make things more complicated legally, or does that actually help?
I think it would help. I mean, a lot of different companies take different approaches. Some of them won't even deliver the tokens until like that lockup is over. And those like early VCs that may have, or insiders that dumped on retail, it's probably because they negotiated a shorter lockup, like a 1 year lockup or 6 month lockup or no lockup. And it's like, again, it all comes down to like how conservative was your legal? Did you get good legal advice? Did you just A lot of law firms honestly want to be yes men because we don't want to be the ones who stop your operations or stop you from getting the deal done. But this is one of the areas that like I think being conservative, at least when you give legal advice, like you're not bound to listen to whatever I say. I'm just going to explain the risk for you and why you should do X instead of Y, and if you go forward with Y, then that's up to you for your risk, whatever risk you're willing to
Yep, and a
take.
lot of these guys are willing to take some big risks, so and
Exactly.
so I guess for the guys that are willing to take those risks, there are a lot of these companies I know, it's like three, four guys, they're trying to bootstrap a project, they're great developers, they know nothing about the legal, they just want to stay out of jail. How does like a small team that maybe hasn't raised a lot of money engage with legal, and when should they engage with legal? I know it's in some cases, it's from what I've read, if you're worried about something, it's sometimes just better to wait for the cease and desist, versus, being really, really smart up front and, potentially spending money you don't have to. So how would you advise like smaller companies that are just trying to get off the ground to make sure they stay out of jail without, blowing their whole budget on legal?
Yeah, that's a like deep question because there's a lot of reasons why I would recommend going to legal from day one, but that day one legal isn't what's we're not worried about like the SEC at that point. It's more like making sure the founders have a straight understanding of what's going on. Documents are drafted accurately because you would be surprised how often we get contacted about founder disputes who were best of friends when it started, even like 6 months in or like a year in. But besides that, I mean, I think anytime you're dealing with equity, you're selling your company's, shares, whether it's preferred stock or common stock to anyone, whether you're hiring an employee and want to give him some incentive or doing like a VC round or angel round or bringing on some type of investor, get legal. If you are anywhere close to launching an NFT or a token, talk to legal. The money is worth it. There are plenty of smaller firms now who specialize in this industry and area, and you don't have to spend $1,000 an hour at, the big law firms. So I don't think there's as much of an excuse to go without it. And you know, you're really talking about like this isn't like, oh, I'll get sued for and I just have to give the money back. It's I'll get sued and I might end up in prison. So yeah, talk to legal anytime you're selling something that isn't the company's product, really. Like if it's a token, if it's equity, if it's I guess an NFT is sort of a product, but in that like category of things, talk to legal before you pull any triggers.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So for companies that maybe don't have the money, I know in the past I've worked with Cooley and they've actually taken equity in one of my companies. Do you think that there are more firms that are willing to do that, or do you think by the nature of crypto they're sort of more risk averse to taking on equity? And if so, you know, how do you think they're making those decisions?
The big firms have like committees that they present the idea to, and you know they have a fund that everyone who wants to participate in participates. I think firms are more open to the idea. The problem with like Web3 crypto companies and taking equity, like stock, like shares in the company, is that if they do release a token or NFT in the future, all of that value is kind of in that. So if you can apportion some for the firm that you work with, that can save you like a good amount in legal costs. I think a lot of firms prefer to get paid, you know, get their invoices paid and then flip it back if they want to invest, rather than taking equity instead. That gives them a little bit more flexibility and they get to see where the company goes before, like, you know, being a first like early investor. So I think it just depends on the firm. I think it's pretty like 50-50 at this point.
Okay. No, that's great to know. And I think it's something that not a lot of like entrepreneurs realize. I think that a lot of these big firms kind of operate as venture arms in some capacity. Or I mean, Cooley was connecting us with investors better than most of our headhunting guys who were finding investors. So they have a lot of times the network, and I'm sure within your own company you probably have a great network of, you know, crypto facing companies who can be partners, investors, all of that. So you've got a lot of
Yeah,
other assets at your disposal.
I think if you know, you, the comp the startup success is the law firm success. Like, we want to continue working with you and helping you grow. So most law firms, if they believe in the founders and, you know, not even necessarily the idea, just like the people are good. If you're a good person to work with and everything, and you're hardworking and have your head on straight, they are more than happy to make the introductions. So I would encourage like founders to ask their counsel, like if they know anyone they can make intros to.
Yeah, I think that's great advice and not something I would have immediately thought of as a founder. You'd kind of box people into their own industries.
Yeah.
So coming back a little bit to some of the more specific like legal issues, have you noticed that there are like certain concerns that say an NFT company is consistently running up against? Is that, you know, intellectual property? Is that just logistically figuring out who owns what, I guess. What are the things that you typically advise an NFT company on, for example?
Yeah, I think something most people don't see and don't anticipate, the IP stuff is like in your face. Like, it's like the first thing people think of. Oh, NFT, who owns the IP rights? Are they infringing on someone else's rights? Like, that's been kind of talked about so much that most founders or companies are aware of it. And most of them, you know, if I'm taking them on as a client, they are not like ripping off someone else's idea. Like, obviously, at least like I wouldn't take on a client like that. I think most law firms wouldn't. But something that they don't anticipate is just, you know, anti-money laundering regulations, money transmission laws, the KYC procedures that, you know, all come with that. That was and still is a huge thing, kind of with like NBA Top Shot. Like, if you wanted to buy one on their platform, you had to go through like a KYC process. Like, they were really on top of it. A lot of times, like, let's say OpenSea, takes a percentage of the transactions, right? You don't want that company to be like, let's say I buy an NFT on OpenSea. The money should not go to OpenSea and then OpenSea moves the money to the seller. That's how you become like a money transmitter and you're subject to more laws. And this isn't foolproof. Like, this is just trying to reduce your risk. That's what legal tries to do. But the money should be directly exchanged through the parties, and OpenSea just like gets its cut out of that exchange instead of holding and moving money for other parties. So it's all about like reducing risk in that sense. And the money laundering laws are actually just like recently started to be enforced in the art world, like the traditional art world. So a lot of attorneys try to make that analogous to the NFT world. So if NFT started maybe like 5, 10 years ago, we would be less worried. But now that they've explicitly included art into it, it's like a huge piece of, building the operations on an NFT company or exchange.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, I'm surprised that they're doing it to the art world, honestly. They're definitely trying to collect. Well, that's super interesting.
There was just a lot of complaints about rich people doing that to like get the either tax write-offs or launder money and things like through art pieces that might not be worth that much, but were getting sold for a lot.
Yep, no, I can say in all the companies I've started, the MTL, AML stuff is always like the first thing you think about, basically. And if you're not thinking about it, you're pretty screwed. So
Yeah,
that's
because it can be expensive to comply with, so you want to make your operations as like, I don't know, economically friendly when it comes to regulations as possible, because it's like state by state, you'll have to go through every agency. It can take 6 figures in legal costs.
Yeah, well, we tried to launch a decentralized exchange back in 2017, like before Uniswap, and we tried to go to every state by state, and get a license, and it was going to cost 25 million to get everything
Oh,
done.
jeez.
So I think New York alone was like 15. So yeah, it's not cheap to get that all. It's cheaper now. They've brought down the bar a little bit, but yeah,
Yeah.
it's a huge consideration.
And that makes sense why most companies will stay out of New York originally and
Yep.
California. So.
Yep. Exactly. So, switching gears a little bit from the company side, if I'm just a retail investor, what kind of things might you suggest I be careful about? So, for example, my uncle just texted me. He's like, I'm trying to find a VPN that'll allow me to like claim this airdrop that's now being restricted from the US. A lot of people in the US are using VPNs to do crazy leverage trading, or they're on Robit or whatever else. So, what kind of warnings would you give retail investors as to the things they, legitimately want to stay away from and be careful about?
Yeah, it's good. It's a good question. I mean, FOMO kind of gets to everyone. It's like, oh, this token is being offered outside the US. I want to be part of it. Like, let me get on this VPN and try to get it, or leverage trade, or all the things you mentioned. But gotta keep in mind, if it ends up being a scam, or you lose all your money, or whatever, you're just put in a bad situation, your remedies are much, much more limited because you went out of your way to kind of go to some website or some company that is more likely than not outside of US jurisdiction. The US is pretty aggressive, the SEC, even FBI, CIA on kind of trying to make that reach and pull international companies into under our jurisdiction. But with Web3, it's even more difficult. If there are legitimately trying to stay out of the US and you go out of your way to participate and you get caught in a fraud scheme, lose all your money, whatever, I think it's less sympathy. You're gonna have a really hard time getting anything back or being able to find justice. So that's something I would say. Be ready to lose everything that you're about to put in. Like, do not put in anything you're willing to lose, not willing to lose.
I'd say that's good advice all around with crypto. Would you say that there are like legitimate remediation options for the US-based firms? Have you noticed that these things are actually getting resolved? I know like Mt. Gox, it's been 10 years. Do you think there are realistic paths where people can be made whole? Do you think that process is getting quicker with time? How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, it's definitely much larger on the radar of the agencies like the FTC, SEC, and the DOJ. So, I think if there's enough complaints, if it's a big enough, like, to be fair, there isn't enough resources in the world to like go after every crypto scam in the world. I mean, like, I don't think Logan Paul has exactly been sued by like a US agency, yeah, for cryptos or whatever. But the bigger the dollar amounts, the more people who write in and complain and tip the agencies, the more likely that they'll go after them. And also being in the US, I mean, you have the option of like bringing a private civil lawsuit and trying to recover money. If, for example, Coinbase did something against the law or treated you unfairly. Like, I know a lot of people somehow get their like funds locked and things like that. Like, you have the option to sue them in court to see if you can come to a resolution. And that's like the great thing about our justice system and being in America. But it has its negatives of being on the company side and dealing with all those lawsuits that might be frivolous that are coming
Yeah, I gotta do that with Gemini. They locked my crypto.
in.
So annoying. That's great to know. Are there any remediation options if it is something abroad? Are you basically just shit out of luck? Or would you still suggest people try?
I mean, if it's some like obscure company that was just formed like a couple months ago and is not really registered anywhere on any type of securities regime. Like, if we're talking like a company based in the UK that's just trying to stay out of the US, maybe if it's worth it, if the dollar amount is big enough, contact an attorney over there and see what your options are. So I mean, it really just depends where they're situated, a lot of context. But yeah, if it's some company based out of China and the founders like on the website, I remember the ICO days, a lot of times the founder images and names and like advisor team were all fake, like all completely fake. It's like, all right, you're probably out of luck here. I mean, no, good luck finding an attorney in China to try to enforce your rights from the US. So yeah, a lot of context is needed, but if it's a big enough amount, I mean, it's worth exploring.
Yeah, well, it's definitely consideration that people should think about as they're investing. One more thing to think about. Are there any like upcoming crypto regulations or recently passed regulations that you're keeping an eye on that you either hope will pass or hope will not pass?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's been so many being proposed by different Congress people. I think there's one bill that's catching a little more traction right now, but it's been to be honest, it's really hard to keep up until something becomes a little more serious because it changes all the time. Something that was super interesting. I think the biggest decision in maybe at least the last year or so was with Ripple and their case with the SEC and how the judge pretty much ruled that it was not a public like securities offering because XRP wasn't the securities. And it was really interesting because transaction rather than XRP itself. So that gave a lot. I mean, the case is still ongoing. That was just like the initial like rejection of, summary judgment on the topic, but it kind of opened the door to characterizing each, crypto or altcoin as a security or not security based on how the company sold the token. So that was pretty like mind-blowing to a lot of people. Even attorneys, I feel like, were a little bit surprised on how that turned out. But yeah, I think that's like the case that I think everyone is really tracking and seeing how that finally turns out.
Yep, definitely. No, I think that one was big. But as always, it seems like they make a judgment, but then it can just go right back and someone kind of overturns it or some other interpretation is made. If you were, in Congress writing the bills, is there any sort of regulation that you would, pass on day one that you feel like would ha really help the industry?
Something I wrote in like that research paper I wrote in law school, I not, compared crypto and ICOs and tokens a lot to SPACs. So I'm not sure how like familiar you are with that, but SPACs were basically raising money on a white paper and saying like in X amount of time, we're going to buy a private company and take them public and start operating it better than the private company does and bringing value to our investors. And their disclosures are really like shell disclosures. It was like, this is who we are and this is what we're going to do. That's about it. And we're raising like however many millions to get it done. And I felt like that was a very similar to ICO. So it's like, why don't we create a similar disclosure system, try to make it a lot cheaper and faster, but give the company like 18 months to bring some of its promises true, and if not, then they have to return whatever is left, like kind of back to the holders. That was kind of a concept that I really thought could work. At least as a base, probably needs to be developed a lot further and figure out like what works for everyone and try to maximize like the retail investors' like protections. But at least that'll bring the people behind the project under like the spotlight and kind of disclosures are, back then like a white paper, like I could post it today and then like update it. And it would depend on someone on Twitter to be like, oh, I noticed like this change, like, oh, these things changed in the white paper. Well, if it's disclosed with the SEC, then it's like, well, we have it in black and white here. We have a record, a paper trail. So I think I would go in that direction. And I think some people in the SEC, like Hester Pierce, may have thought of a similar idea. So I like that route. I think that makes it more accessible for everybody. A little bit more protection for the investors, a little bit more obligation and responsibility on the company without like totally crushing them in costs and compliance.
Yep, I think that makes perfect sense. I did a lot of work with like M&A with a bunch of Canadian companies who wanted to launch these SPACs through the TSX, and they were just wheeling and dealing. But most of them just had friends with a pink sheet shell corp that they knew they could just port everything into. And so that was kind of the limiting factor, was it was all a very specific sort of group of people who had these shell corps just sitting on the shelf ready to go. And I think democratizing that out to sort of the next generation a little bit and doing it that way, I think makes a lot of sense. Are there certain trends you've noticed, maybe not even specific to crypto, but just specific to the startup industry in general, as sort of interest rates have come up and fundraising strategies may have changed? Have you noticed that the companies coming to you might be sort of planning for the future differently, or might be, I guess, changing their go-to-markets accordingly, or changing their fundraising strategies, based on how the economy is doing at the moment.
It's changed a lot. I mean, 2020 through 2022 was, if you had an idea, a good idea, and had some qualifications, you could raise millions off of that, which was crazy. But now, and people were rushing, just everything was rushed. Building the product, hiring team, raising the money, like just it was moving so fast. Now more people are willing to, people still in the game, still building, are more willing to bootstrap for longer. Like if you're starting a company now, be ready to bootstrap for a lot longer. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's actually a good thing. Get your valuation up higher, give less equity, answer to less investors, do your own thing. And you see how like after Elon Musk kind of took Twitter private, like how much more agile it is, for better or for worse. For better or for worse, it's a lot more agile. Things are changing so much faster. There's less people to answer to. One guy pretty much in control. That's you. That's how your startup is if it's just you and your co-founders versus when you bring investors on board. Because now you're bogged down with like answering them, meeting their expectations. Now you're on a clock where investors are like, are you on the path to go public or be acquired in 5 to 10 years, within 7 years? And so that's like a lot of pressure. Now people are taking their time, building maybe a little bit more slowly, but they're bootstrapping it, and they're planning to raise money maybe a year or 18 months after they start the company, versus a couple of years ago, it was like we would incorporate the company because there was already a term sheet that was like ready to go and get signed. So people are just generally taking more time to do the research on product market fit and building their product and getting traction before raising money.
Yeah, I think people are just building much healthier companies now because they have to, and the people who aren't willing to do it are getting out of the game, and they were never really that committed to the mission to begin with. And I think it is very telling. I mean, I've raised a lot of venture capital money, and it's very frustrating because they always give you these KPIs to hit. They say, "We got you for the next round, just do this," and then you do it, and you come back to them and they say, "Well, that wasn't, actually what we wanted." And so you have all these founders spending a ton of time and energy, working towards goals that they might not themselves think are actually that important to the company. And I've wasted a ton of time doing that. And I think there is honestly going to be a lot of potential for, I think, retail to fill some of those gaps, which I think is, if we can find a way for crypto to make these things accessible to retail to cut the venture out, I think that's the direction a lot of these companies would like to go. Certainly, my friends in crypto would much rather raise from retail than from venture. But I think the big issue with that is legal. They just don't know how to do it legally, and they don't know if it's going to cost more to set up legally than it would to just go to venture capital and have them deal with it. Do you have any suggestions on raising from retail? Is that basically something you suggest against at any given time, or is there just a certain strategy you need to utilize, like selling a utility token that can be redeemed for like future services or something?
Yeah, right now it's still pretty uncertain. I mean, it's more certain that the SEC will view it as a security than not, and that means you could only sell to accredited investors. There are offerings that you could do, like Reg A Plus. It costs a little bit more in legal compliance, but that's a way. I mean, you could sell to retail, and usually what happens is there are plenty of services out there that'll like bundle up all those retail investors into like a SPV, and someone will manage that SPV. So you're really like just answering one like administrative person who's really just making sure there's no like fraud going on at the company. So that makes it a lot easier. It's just there is a little bit more compliance cost. So in short, like just going straight to retail, just selling your token like publicly like that or any equity in general is not a good idea right now. Like what you might get away with it, but you might not. Just like anything that's viewed as a crime, right? You might get away with it, but you might not.
On the flip side, if you were just to do it as NFTs instead, does that change the calculus?
Yeah, so if the NFT is just art, I think most lawyers are pretty comfortable with that being publicly sold, as long as the money laundering and KYC is covered. You don't want people, criminals, or people, like for example, right now there's so many heavy sanctions on Russia. You don't want people there being able to launder their money through your NFTs. That can get you in a lot of trouble. And the responsibility really is on the company. Like that's how we view it in the US. Our laws are where you're selling this product online, it's your responsibility to make sure that nobody in the sanctioned countries or on certain lists or money laundering is taking place through the purchase of your product. So as long as that's covered and it's art and you're not really gonna do anything after to try to make that art more valuable, like that should be okay.
Awesome. That's great advice and good to know. So this is my last question, and this is, pretty open-ended, so feel free to go at it however you wish. But are there any companies, any projects, any new technologies, either in the space or outside of the space, that you're really excited about, that you think people should be paying attention to, or that you think are solving a very real problem in the space?
Oh, that's a loaded question. Something it might be very, very early still, but that I think is very important is a decentralized AI product. Like I know AI is very, very hot right now, but one of the problems is when one company is in control of the entire training set that the AI is building on. There are so many ways that could go wrong with, I mean, we've seen it already with ChatGPT. Like, I think you can ask it to say a joke about Donald Trump, but it won't say a joke about Biden. It's like, okay, this thing is already making like decisions for people based on the comp what the company felt like is right or wrong. So I think through Web3, an AI product like ChatGPT, there are companies working on it. I just feel like it's so early that there isn't one that anyone would feel comfortable using yet, but that is free of that kind of like one person controlling it and telling it what data to use and not use and what it can do or can't do. So that's something that I think people are like, Web3 is over, AI is in. Well, I think those two things can actually coexist very well and create something even better.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's I'm actually working on something similar to that, so I'll tell you about it after, but I think you're spot on with that.
That's
And
exciting.
the world of data I think needs to converge with the world of crypto a little bit. I think there's a lot of cool stuff that can be done once we add a little bit more to the identity layer and add a little bit more data to figuring out who people are and where the money is going. It'll help with AML and KYC and all that stuff all the way down the line. But that was great. This was exactly what I was hoping for. I think people got a lot of really great free legal advice, so they have a lot of thanks to give there. If you could maybe just tell people where to find you, where to learn more about your company, and any parting thoughts you might want to have towards the end here.
Yeah, the best way to learn more about me and my firm is at decryptedlaw.com. Same handle for our Instagram and TikTok. We make informational but hopefully entertaining short clips too there that could be helpful. And yeah, our firm works a little bit differently. We try to do everything on the upfront flat fee basis, so you know exactly what you're spending on. That was a common pain point with our founders, and also a subscription model so that you have open communication with your attorneys for a low monthly fee. That was another pain point where it was like people would email us with the problem and then get a surprise $2,000 bill in the mail.
Yeah.
I'm sure
That's a
you've
great
experienced
idea.
that. So
Yeah.
people are afraid of talking to their attorneys. So we're trying to solve for that pain point. Something we learned from our founder clients was some of the most successful ones were the ones that solved the biggest and most obvious pain points. So that's what we're trying to do. So happy to help any
Yeah.
listeners.
No, that's great. When you're operating on a budget, it's great to know exactly how much you're paying every month. And
Exactly.
no, that's brilliant though. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I think people got a lot of value out of this. And thank you guys for listening. I appreciate it. I'll put all of his links in the episode description, and we'll be back again soon with another episode. Thank you guys, and have a great day.
Thanks.